Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
On November 15th, 1970, the Marshall University football team perished in a plane crash. Our guest tonight became the head coach to rebuild this football program. He soon came to realize he was rebuilding the entire community of Huntington, West Virginia. Matthew McConaughey played him in the 2006 movie, We Are Marshall. His name, Jack Lengel, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's Jack.
We're with the former head coach of Marshall University football program, Jack Lengel. Jack, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you very much, Jack. It's good to be with you. Apologize, I have a little laryngitis, but I think I'll be fine.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Sure. My parents are from Hungary, Budapest, and Satmar. We lived in a three-room house in Akron, Ohio, and I slept with my dad till I was about 21 years old. We were poor, and we really didn't know it. And my mother and father never even went to high school, and always my dad would always encourage me that you've got to go to college, like most immigrants did, and I'm first generation, so I went to Akron University on a football. Actually, I went to as a walk-on my first football year. Then they gave me a scholarship in January, and then I had a full scholarship for 4 years. Then they hired me as a freshman coach. Then I went to the service with the paratroopers at Fort Bragg. Then came back on and coached football there. Then I came back on the varsity staff at Akron University, Heidelberg, and then Cornell University in the Ivy League, then the College of Worcester, then Marshall University.
What did you learn from your mom, Jack, and what did you learn from your dad?
Well, we learned that you had to be a hard worker. You had to work for what you got, and you had to persevere, regardless of the circumstances. And I think that was the genesis of my background from my father and my parents, my mother. And I think those particular basic core values served me well in my entire football and college career and in my professional career as an athletic director.
You got a degree from Akron. When you went home and told your mom and dad, these Romanian people, that you were going to work as a football coach, what did they tell you?
Well, I started out in business first, and then I was offered the freshman coaching job for $3,284. And by that time, I was married, and I accepted it. Then told my mom and dad. My mom and dad had no problem with it. My dad was just proud that I graduated from, and my mom was proud that I just graduated from the university. So they really were not concerned about me going into college football at all.
The first time you were a head coach was the College of Worcester. Talk about those days, if you would.
Well, when I was at the College of Worcester, I received the college coaching job from when I was at Cornell. I had signed a contract to go to Duke University. And about 6 days before, I was invited to interview at the College of Worcester, which I did, and except that the position came home on a Saturday and changed the moving van directions from Durham, North Carolina, to Worcester, Ohio. And I was a head football coach at the age of 29. And it was a very rewarding experience and opportunity. And so I was thrilled to be a head coach. And I remember when we had just played for the championship. It was my fourth year. We had lost the championship game to Wittenberg. And I was watching on the television that night, and the bottom of the crawl on the screen came across, Marshall University football team killed in the crash. All 75 on board are presumed dead. And my heart just sunk, like I'm sure every football coach in the country that saw that did. And I, my first thought was, but for the grace of God, there go my football team and our coaching staff. And so I watched with great interest what transpired. They offered a job to a Penn State coach. He turned it down. About several weeks later, they offered it to a Georgia Tech coach. He accepted the job, stayed 2 days, and resigned for personal reasons. And I got to thinking to myself, well, you know, maybe I can help. So I called, I was interviewed, and I was offered the job. I was probably their last choice because they had spring practice coming up in 31 days. And so I went down and became the head football coach at Marshall University.
The guy that had the job for 2 days, when he realized there were only three varsity players, those three had stayed home from that fateful day because they were injured, one assistant coach who decided to drive home because he wanted to do some recruiting on the way home. Why did you ever take the job under those circumstances?
Well, actually, there were two coaches. There was Carl Coker and Mickey Jackson and Red Dawson that were there. But the reason I took the job is there's an old Chinese proverb that says if you're ever given something of value, you have a moral obligation to pass it on. Well, I was given something of value by being allowed to be a freshman football coach, college coach, and a head coach at the age of 29. And I thought to myself, here's my chance to pay back to football what it gave to me, the opportunity to be a head coach. So I was very pleased to accept that responsibility and see if I could help, and I thought I could help him.
You soon came to realize, and I quote, "I thought I was coming to rebuild a football program. It turned out to be the whole community I was rebuilding."
Well, what happened, Jack, when I got down there, I found out that there were 24 boosters on that plane, 24 leading citizens, four doctors and their wives, another doctor, state senator, city councilman, dean of admissions, director of athletics, vice presidents of corporations, 70 children without one parent, and 18 without two parents. So as you can see, it took a wide swath out of the community, the university administration, and the 37 football players, five coaches, six administrators, and the 24 boosters.
We're talking to Jack Lengel, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Jack Lengel, who was the athletic director at the United States Naval Academy from 1988 to 2001. Quite a career. Jack, you take this job on, you've basically got no kids, and talk about what your president did for you in front of the NCAA.
Well, basically, we had 24 freshmen that were remaining. There was approximately 37 on the freshman team, but many of them had transferred out after the crash, and schools came in and took off the top players. And we had 24 players. Our president and athletic director went to Walter Byers, president of the NCAA, to get permission to play freshmen, which they granted to us. Which was very, very helpful. As we started our recruiting process without the freshman eligibility rule, it was very difficult. Many parents did not want their sons to go to Marshall University, particularly after an air crash. But with the freshman eligibility rule, I could talk to players of having an opportunity to play Division I-A football as a freshman and contribute to laying the foundation for the football team that on future years would be successful. And as I told them, I can't promise you championships. I can't promise you all conference or bowl games, but I can promise you, all I can ever promise you is what Walt Winston Churchill once said, blood, sweat, and tears, but that I will promise you that on future years when this team is successful on other fields and on other days, we will look back and share in those victories with them. And that's exactly what happened.
You decided, Jack, to run the Veer offense. So you go to your arch rival, West Virginia, because they were the best at the Veer, and you ask them to teach it to you. And the coach at the time was a fella named Bobby Bowden. Talk about that.
Well, Bobby, they weren't arch rivals quite yet. Marshall was not playing West Virginia at that time. But I did see that they were running the Veer offense. When we after I interviewed all of the players, I realized we only had a couple receivers and maybe two quarterbacks, no vertical depth in the line, no offense, defensive linemen, linebackers, defensive halfback. So I knew we couldn't line up in a tight formation. They would blitz us and we wouldn't get off the ground. But the Houston veers a concept offense. You don't run a play. And it has two wide receivers. So now the defense has to put two people outside against your two wideouts. That leaves only nine people inside. We're going to option the end and the tackle. That's good because we don't have good linemen to block them that have the experience. It wasn't that they weren't good people. It was that they were inexperienced as freshmen playing against a varsity football team. So as a result, it gave us lateral and vertical distribution of the defense so that we could throw the football and open it up for the option. The only problem was that our quarterback had never run the option, Reggie Oliver. But as a result, he took quite a beating. But it did allow us to throw the football, open the offense and defense up, and allowed us to have an opportunity to score. So I called Bobby, and he invited our whole staff up. We watched practice in the morning and the afternoon. Then Frank Signetti, his offensive coordinator, who went on to be the head coach when Bobby left to go to Florida State, taught us the offense. So we learned it in 3 days, and at night we would study the film from about 12 till 1, 2 in the morning. And then we went down to Marshall University in 3 days, modified it, simplified it, put it in as an offense, and we started teaching it to our team for spring practice. And we only had 43 players at that time, with the freshman team and walk-ons, ex-servicemen, three basketball players that wanted to help us out. All three of them made the varsity football team, playing out their fifth year of eligibility by the NCAA. They had completed their 4 years of eligibility in basketball. And so we put the offense together. We played our spring game against the varsity alumni and beat them 26-0, which was a great, great game because it was a very important game for the community and for the coaching staff because it showed we could run the offense, we could play defense, we could score, and we could win. And that gave the whole community of Huntington, West Virginia, and our football staff and players hope, hope for the future and hope for our opening football season in 2 months.
Talking about the opening season, your first actual game was September 18th, 71, an away game at Morehead State. Can you talk about that game, Jack?
Well, we opened with Morehead, and it was an away game. But before I took them over to play that game, I took the whole team up to Spring Hill Cemetery, and it's a cemetery that overlooks the campus and the community, and there's a 13-foot obelisk there that has the names of the players and the coaches and the boosters and the crew members that were killed in the tragic plane crash. And out in front it has six unmarked graves with a bronze plaque in the middle with the players' names on who were burnt beyond recognition. We did not have DNA at that time, and therefore they were buried in that cemetery plot. And I took the team up there, only the football team, the coaches, players, and managers. No one else. We did not tell the press. We did not tell boosters. We did not tell the administration. And, in fact, when Warner Brothers came down to film the movie, they never knew about this particular situation. In fact, my backup quarterback was a sports editor for the Huntington Post-Dispatch, and one of his writers said, I've worked with him for 30-some years. He's never told me that story. It was our private moment, and we never told anybody about it. But what I would do with that freshman team, I took them up there and said, these are your teammates. These are the reasons why you're playing at Marshall University, to build the foundation that on future days and future fields will bear the fruits of success, and you will share in those successes as we move forward. So it was a very private moment, and that's what we did. Then we went to play Morehead, and to have that football team run out on that field approximately 9 months after that tragic plane crash that killed the whole varsity team was just a victory in itself. And we scored our first touchdown, a 16-yard screen pass play from Reggie Oliver to Tom Smith, and Tom just dove in the end zone. Now, in the fourth quarter, he was 16-6, playing very well against a very seasoned football team. But then, in the fourth quarter, they wore us down, beat us 29-6. Now, during that game, we did not do very well in our extra points and field goals. So I put an ad in the student newspaper in the Parthenon saying, room, board, books, tuition, fees, for anybody that can kick an extra point or a field goal. Well, we had about 14 guys show up for practice at the end of practice on Monday, and we kicked them all, and they weren't very good, to be honest with you. And then I looked over to the left, and I see this hippie guy standing there, long hair, scraggly beard, soccer uniform, soccer shoes. I said, son, are you here to kick? He said, yes, sir. I said, you ever kick a football? He said, oh, yeah, occasionally. I said, you ever kick a football game? He said, no, sir. I figured, come on over, let's get this over so we can go eat dinner. We put him on the 3-yard line directly in front of the goalpost. He thumps it. We move it back 5 yards on the left hash. He thumps it 15 on the right hash. We're back to the 20-yard line. He's thumping him through. And I said, son, get a haircut, shave. You got a scholarship, room, board, books, tuition, and fees. And that's how we got Blake Smith. Now, in the fourth quarter, or in the first quarter against Xavier, which was our first home game, we were on about the 14-yard line. I said, Blake, are you ready to kick that field goal? He said, yes, sir. Send him in. He kicks the field goal. And we're leading 3-0 at halftime against a team that we were 3-touchdown underdogs. So it worked out well.
We're talking to Jack Lingle. When we come back, we'll ask him about what happened in that second half against Xavier on September 25th, 1971. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Presented by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're talking to Jack Lingle, who rebuilt the Marshall University football program in 1971. Jack, your first home game against Xavier. Talk about the second half of that game.
Well, we were leading 3-0 at halftime, and right before I sent the team out, I told him, gentlemen, in the palm of your hands, you have one of the greatest upsets in the history of college football. All I need from you is about 30 more minutes of determination, dedication, hard-nosed football, just like you played in the first half, and you'll have a memory that will last you a lifetime. And we went out, and they scored a touchdown. It's 3-6. We come back in the fourth quarter, and we score. It's 9-6. Now, I sent Reggie out. We've got ball possession, and I said, Reggie, get 2 first downs, and we'll punt the football away, play defense, and win this game. We missed the first down by 2 inches, so we have to punt the football. And John Gomfrisser, great tailback, took the football back 47 yards. Now it's 13-9. He scores the touchdown. And there's about 4 minutes to go. We get the ball. We can't move it. We punt it. They start to move the football. Then Chuck Wright breaks through and gets some tackles and for a loss. And then they've got to punt the football back to us. We get the ball on our 48-yard line. And we throw 3 incomplete passes. Our fourth pass, we hit Jerry Arrowsmith for about 15 yards, first down. Next pass to Kelly Sherwood, we hit about 15 more yards for a first down. Now, we're marching down the field. We're about on the 18-yard line. And we tell Jerry Arrowsmith, we're going to throw you a bootleg pass, Jerry. Get the ball and get out of bounds. Well, he catches the pass, can't get out of bounds, and they stop him about 2 yards from the sideline, and the clock is running 8-7. So Red Dawson calls down a play that we had run the quarter before and got 25 yards on, 2-13 bootleg throwback pass, which is the same play. It looks like the bootleg, but then we throw it back across the field to Terry Gardner, who slips out of the backfield going to the left. Now the clock is going down. We get it in, and Reggie's under center, and it's 5-4. We're yelling, Reggie, snap the ball. 3-2, snap the ball. And with 1 second, Reggie snaps the ball. The gun goes off. Reggie fakes the dive, rolls for the bootleg. The defense rolls with him, and then he pulls up inside the tackle box, throws back to Terry Gardner, and there's one guy that didn't rotate, and that was a defensive back corner on the left-hand side. Jack Crabtree pulls out, levels him, and Terry Gardner catches the ball, runs in the end zone, unmolested, and we win 15-13. Now the crowd comes completely out of the stadium. They're over the walls, on the field. I'm running across the field. Someone's jerking on me, pulling my shirt. They says, Coach, do I get to kick the extra point? I said, son, we won the ball game. The game is over. So we go in the locker room, and the team throws everybody in the showers, including Father Scott, our priest. And about an hour and 45 minutes later, after our press conference and everything, I come out, and the stadium is packed. People still in the stands hugging and crying, on the field grabbing, hugging each other. Because everybody had a friend, a neighbor, a classmate, a teammate on that football team. That was a very, very emotional game. And not unlike the game when Bobby Pruitt went 15-0, when they won that national championship, the students tore down the goalpost and took it up to the cemetery at Spring Hill Cemetery and laid this, the goalpost on top of those six unmarked graves. So it was, it was a story about Marshall's story. Success had many fathers, and the story is about a community and a football team and a town that came together to face adversity and do what I think is one of the greatest lessons in athletics, and that's to face adversity, get back up off the ground, and go on to continued success. So it was a great moment in history, in football history, and for that community. And Bobby Pruitt took it to the pinnacle because starting in 1995, Marshall University had the greatest success, one-loss success, in any other team in Division 1A. Not Notre Dame, not Southern Cal, not Ohio State. Marshall University was the winningest football program in the NCAA Division 1A category. And we often talk about from the ashes to the phoenix, and that credit goes to Bobby Pruitt. There were many, many people. I laid the foundations, and then we had another coach came in, and he had his first winning season. Then George Chomp came in, played for the national championship. Jim Donnan won two national championships and went to Georgia. Then Bobby Pruitt came in and put the culmination of a great success story of a community, a university, and a football team. And the Marshall story, We Are Marshall, is really not a football story as much as it is a story about a community facing adversity.
You won a second game in 71. Can you share with us that second victory?
That was Bowling Green, and that was probably the Marshall Xavier game was in a very emotional game for the community. The stadium was packed, people outside trying to get in, et cetera, et cetera. That was the one that gave everybody hope and faith in what we were trying to accomplish. The Bowling Green game, they were undefeated coming down to Marshall. Don Nalen was their coach, and Donnie was ended up at West Virginia, did a great job, one of the fine coaches at West Virginia, great career record, outstanding individual. And they had a football player named Paul Miles. I think he had like 34 consecutive games of 100 yards or more. I mean, this was going to be a no-contest game on the way to the Citrus Bowl for Bowling Green. They were ranked number 5 in the nation in offense. And we win the game 12-10. And it was one of the great upsets of an outstanding football game. It wasn't the emotional game, although it had great emotion in it, but it was a game against an outstanding nationally ranked team. And we won it 12-10, and it was at homecoming. And it was really a big, big, significant game and gave us our second victory for the Young Thundering Herd. Now, the name of the team was the Thundering Herd. We changed it to the Young Thundering Herd because they were all freshmen.
You stayed for 4 years. Your record there was 9-33. Jack, what was the single biggest thing you learned from that four-year experience?
I learned that, to have faith and hope and perseverance are critical factors, core values that allow you to turn adversity into success and to develop the foundation that's necessary to give the players and the community the lessons that you needed to learn to sustain your effort, that you can face adversity, that you can overcome adversity, and that you can be successful. It may take perseverance, it may take setbacks, but as long as you're focusing on the core values of faith and hope and perseverance, you ordinary people can do extraordinary things.
2006, they make the movie We Are Marshall. And Matthew McConaughey, chosen by People magazine as the sexiest man alive, plays you. What was that like?
It was a burden. It was a burden. I mean, I have never faced so many comments from my friends, et cetera, about Matthew McConaughey. They don't come up to me and say, Jack, how you doing? How's everything going? How are the kids? How's Sandy? They say, Jack, can you get me Matthew's autograph for my wife? I mean, he is an outstanding actor. Now, I will say this. My sideburns weren't quite as long as Matthew's. I did not have a 5 o'clock shadow. I did not dress like Matthew. I was more of an Ivy League dresser. And I didn't act quite as quirky as he did. But in his own way, he put together a performance that was outstanding. It told the story about Marshall University. And I was walking back from the set one night with him in Atlanta. I spent several weeks on the set watching the filming and so forth. And he made him call, and he made the whole crew call him Coach Langle the whole time he was filming, because he was really into the story. Now, he gets $12 million a movie, and he took about $1.2 million for this. I said, why would you do that? And he said, Jack, because, you know, sometimes it's, you never get the opportunity to do a real live story. And he said this, and he loves football, graduated from the University of Texas, was on the sideline when Texas beat Southern Cal for the national championship. And he said, you know, I looked at all your material. I studied articles. I looked at the photographs. I looked at your playbook. He said, I internalized it as an actor. Then I portrayed it. And he said, you know, Jack, I did not try to mimic you. I said, Matthew, I'm really glad you told me that, because I was never that animated on the sidelines. And we both kind of laughed. But I thought he did a terrific job of pulling a movie together with outstanding actors like David Strathairn, who's up for the Academy Award in Good Night, Good Luck, played the role of Edward R. Murrow, and Kate Mara, who is supposed to be the next outstanding female star in Hollywood, and the actor from Deadwood, who plays the innkeeper, who's a brilliant English actor. He did a terrific job in the film as well. So they had a very, very strong cast. And I thought Matthew McConaughey did an excellent job in the movie.
We're talking to Jack Lengel, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm, presents Anything Is Possible with Jack Rasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Jack Lengel, a former head coach of the University of Marshall football program. Jack, when you first saw that movie, We Are Marshall, what did you think about while you watched that movie?
Well, the first time I saw it, I was very, very frustrated, because I was really down in the grass looking at the details. And you know, as a football coach, you want to see everything exactly as it is in replication, et cetera. And Hollywood will take certain facts, composite characters, and will tell a story. They have to have used composite characters, and they have to weave a story in there to make it interesting. So the reality of the of more like a documentary versus a movie struck me. But as I continue to review the movie, I came to the understanding of where Hollywood, we both start from the same point, but we end up in a little bit different a final story, because they have to tell the story, and they have to change some facts a little bit. But overall, I think they did an outstanding job of telling the story when I stepped back and understood their methodology. And so I thought the movie was well done. It told the story 37 years ago that needed to be told to people today, and I thought they did an excellent job.
Columbine High School, Virginia Tech, Northern Illinois University. What do you say to those students, Jack, the teachers, administration, alumni, and the townspeople?
I tell them to remember those that were involved in the tragedy, that possibly lost their lives, were injured, and remember them in your hearts, and remember them and talk about them, and keep them close to your hearts and your thoughts, and that's how you honor them. You honor them as people that were part of your lives. There's adversity in everybody's lives. And adversity is part of your developing character. And how you face that adversity is a critical factor about you and how you move forward. And you honor them by remembering them as friends, as people that were classmates, as people that you associated with. And their memories are always going to be a part of you. And I think then as an administration, I think you look at those particular circumstances and you start asking yourself, what could we have done better to protect the students? And these types of situations seem to be more prevalent today in a copycat fashion. And I think administrations and state governments and city administrations and universities must work collectively together to improve their communication, not only in the verification of who these students are, what potential problems they may present psychologically, have they bought guns, et cetera, et cetera, but to close communication coordination for expediency and resolving these particular issues to minimize, because I don't think you can ever eliminate these kinds of situations with human nature being what it is. But I think we all have got to do a better job of teaching respect in our schools. It starts, respect starts with self-respect, and then respect, and then integrate quality communications and prior planning to prevent these types of tragedies becoming greater because of lack of communications, lack of proper planning. These are the things that I think we should learn as students, as administrators, and as governments to protect our most prized possessions, which are our students. And I think there was a tragedy in New Brunswick, Bathurst High School, New Brunswick, Canada, where a van coming back from a basketball game skidded off the road. Coach's wife was killed and 7 basketball players. Well, from that particular tragedy, all these same principles are applicable. But in that particular tragedy, I cautioned the Canadian government that they should not be using vans. They should be supplying 25-passenger buses with certified drivers. That's the least we can do to protect the most prized possession that we as parents and as teachers have, and that's our students and our student athletes.
Can you talk about your experience at the Naval Academy as director of athletics for 13 years?
That was a great experience. My 2 sons graduated from there, David and Peter. David is a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps, works for NASA, and Peter is a commander in the Navy, works at the Paris Embassy, the United States Embassy, and runs the Paris Air Show, will be coming out here and finishing his 23 years of service. They love to tell the story. I got there after them. They love to tell the story. They both got me the job, which probably has some truth to it. And, of course, I think the lessons from the Naval Academy is you have great kids to work with, kids that are not quite 6 foot or 7 foot tall, although David Robinson defied that as he grew while he was at the Naval Academy. But athletes that grow into their abilities by good coaching, good environment, good academic support, I think all the elements that should be in every school, high school and college, and that is all the support elements to make them better students, better citizens, better military officers, and better student athletes, and learning from all those circumstances to go on to be a great leader. The Naval Academy is a leadership institution. Yes, you'll get a degree in English and history and business and computers or what have you, but their number one emphasis is leadership. And for that, I think they're one of the greatest educational institutions in the country, our service academies are. Navy, Air Force, and Army are outstanding institutions committed to leadership for this country.
What makes a great coach, Jack?
I think a great coach is a coach that not only knows his strategy and the technicalities of the sport, but that he's a listener and he's an adjuster. He's willing to change as change dictates and mandates it. He's willing to look at athletes, and although he may be running a system that may be what he believes to be his system, on an annual basis he adapts that to the talent that he has. He is compassionate and understands, is a disciplinarian, knows how to push when he needs to be pushed, knows when to hug and how to hug, and can communicate effectively to them their objectives, their goals, and brings the people together as a team, and team is spelled without an I, and it has that ability to lead by example. It's the old adage, what you do speaks so loudly, I cannot hear what you're saying. So he or she must be a leader and walk. She or he leads the particular groups or talents of the individuals and walks softly behind them as they take the leadership role.
Last question, Jack. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
I think the young listeners today need to have a greater emphasis on understanding self-respect and respect. And the other thing is, I would hope that all of them start to learn how to make a plan for success. Now, some people call it a strategic plan. You can call it whatever you want. But, you know, a short pencil is better than a long memory. And I ask them to write down, what are your goals for this year? What are your goals for 3 or 4 years from now when you're graduating from high school or college, and what are your lifetime goals? What do you want them to put on your tombstone? And keep it simple. We have an old adage in football, KISS, keep it simple, stupid. But just write down 4 or 5 things or 6 things. Well, I wouldn't go more than 7 or 8 for what you want to accomplish this year, 3 years from now. And then pull it out of your middle drawer and look at it every other 3 or 4 weeks. And learn to write affirmations. Affirmations are things in your cognitive thinking power, which is your subconscious mind. It doesn't know the difference between right and wrong. So therefore, whatever you tell it, you will achieve it. You will work towards that particular goal. It doesn't know right from wrong, and it will guide you. And as a result, avoid negative people, avoid negative self-talk, avoid negative circumstances, work in the positive and affirmative. And when you write these affirmations, you write them as if they've already happened. And you read them every morning. And you write, I am an outstanding student athlete, and a student that commits myself to respecting others and respecting myself. And you write it as if it's already happened. That's who you are. I am an outstanding speaker. I remember names because I have word association for those names. And you read these in the morning, and what you think about is exactly what you become. So I think those kinds of things I wish somebody had told me when I was a young student in grade school, high school, college, and I wish I would have taken them and written them down and achieved those particular processes early on in life. And I think if students will do that, we will have a better prepared student who will be respectful of others and other people, and they tend to eliminate negative things like Columbine and circumstances beyond our control.
Jack Langle, it was an honor to have you. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Jack.
Our guest next Sunday will be another classy leader, the Quiet Assassin, the president of the Detroit Pistons, Joe Dumars. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spawn.